This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. One of the themes that has come up over and over again in 2025 is funding cuts. We told you about cuts that Congress was considering for Meals on Wheels, the loss of funding for public broadcasting, the impact of the government shutdown. One of our favorite conversations earlier this year focused on the changing landscape of news for Abilene. Here's an excerpt. It's no secret that across West Texas and the United States, fewer journalists are on the scene. Last week, the Abilene ABC affiliate laid off close to half its workforce. But they're not alone. The NBC and CBS affiliates merged years ago to consolidate staff and have since had layoffs of their own. The Abilene Reporter News has a very small, hardworking staff doing the job that dozens once did. Why is this happening? What does it mean for West Texas in the future? Joining us in the studio are Glenn Dromgoole, current owner of the Texas Star Trading Company and former newspaper editor at the Abilene Reporter News, and Braid Blanks, who spent over a decade anchoring the news at K-Texas TV in Abilene. And a reminder, I was a longtime employee of that same news organization. Welcome to you both. Glenn, we're going to start with you. And this is a pretty broad question, but describe your time at the paper. When did you leave? How many were in the newsroom when you left?
Well, I came here in almost 40 years ago, in 1985. And at the time, I think we had 56 on the news staff. And by the time I left, we had consolidated the morning and afternoon editions and all that, and dropped the afternoon paper. And we were down to 46. We had 46 editorial employees at the time. And that included probably six or seven editors, and then mostly reporters and copy editors and photographers and that sort of thing. And I think today they have three.
Braid, yeah. To you, when did you leave K-Texas? And were you seeing this contraction in news when you left?
I left in 2017. Hours for journalists are never easy, especially with family. But I didn't leave because I didn't love it. I think you could see the writing on the wall. I think we were watching the paper closely because that was it was pretty shocking to us when so many people were getting laid off and the shift of it. I don't think the news industry, the broadcast news industry, had quite gotten to that point at that time. But you could see, especially when the NBC and CBS affiliates merged, I thought that was pretty telling.
Yeah, it did feel telling at the time. Talk about now, what kind of changes are you seeing when you turn on a newscast compared to when you were on a few years ago?
I hate to say this, it kind of feels a little bit hollow. Not always, but sometimes you can just sense more of the fast-paced, more graphic. It seems more of a production. And I feel like, there are still some great news stories being told, and I love that. But I feel like in the past, it was a lot more about interaction. And I think that was part of why people felt so connected to the news, is because there was that human aspect of it. And I feel like, now it's a little bit more fast-paced. You have the flashy graphics. You have lots of different types of news being run. But I think it's just a bit of a deviation from what I guess we would call old school, George.
Well, it almost seems like that's kind of a luxury of having a bigger staff.
Yeah.
And as far as the reporter news goes, it's been to save their necks that they've kept cutting.
Well, they've had to cut because they don't have the advertising support they did at one time. And when I was there, the newspaper probably reached 70% of the homes in Abilene. Today they reach maybe 10%. I don't even know if it's that much.
I've got some numbers. In 1991, circulation was 43,000. And that's according to the Texas State Historical Association. In 2023, it was 4,000. So about 90% of the audience left. And a question I tend to hear, and this is for you, Glenn, is it because of changing habits or because the paper is contracting and offering less each day? In other words, kind of a chicken and egg thing.
Some of each, probably. We knew back years ago that young people weren't reading newspapers. We had programs to try to combat that, newspapers in classrooms, newspapers in schools, that sort of thing. But we knew even our own children weren't reading the newspapers, adult children. And it was going to catch up with them at some point. And what caught up with them eventually was the Internet. and people started getting their news in a different way. And so the golden years, I considered the kind of the time when I was here, those are gone, and I don't think the newspapers will never get that back. In the meanwhile, I mean, you had the loyal readers, the people that wanted to have a newspaper every day to start their day, and there's still some of them around, but they've raised the circulation rate so much to combat loss of advertising that they're eventually running off nearly all of those people. The number you quoted of the 4,000 2023, mm-hmm. I think it was 2,400 last year, same time.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's probably less than 2,000 now. I don't know. It's yeah. But now there are a lot of people that are taking it digitally, and that number doesn't count that. The number that you quoted and that I just quoted doesn't include digital. So, and they've been trying to move people into that because right. That's the direction to go. Printing and throwing a newspaper in somebody's yard that's gone. At best, I would be surprised if within 2 or 3 years we just have maybe a weekly print product and daily online.
Brad, the quality of local news or the newspaper, fewer reporters obviously on the ground. Is the quality where it should be? Is it what we deserve here in Abilene?
Well, first let me say I have tremendous respect for our former news station and the Abilene Reporter News, but I guess I would be speaking on just behalf of broadcast news. I feel like the reason that the foundation of a journalist is from those who are there that are more experienced. So when you are getting these brand new people coming in with very minimal staff that's already there with probably a high turnover rate, you just will be lacking in the depth of the newsroom with teachers. So I do feel like I've seen quite a shift from where we started when we had, you know, the Paul Browns and the Wayne McCormicks who taught you how to be unbiased, how to demand excellence from yourself for the community, because that was so important to all of us. And it was really something that I think that brought us together and made our station stand apart. We wanted to make sure that the quality of our reporting was fair, honest, that we were telling good news, that we were sourcing things properly. So I think that you see a lot now in terms of quality in a bit of a decline, and possibly because of that aspect of there's just not teachers with experience there for many reasons. I think that there's a lot of great places, ACU, of course, I'm biased, but they train students really well out of college. But if you don't have that background and you don't have a teacher at the station, I think you just kind of are shooting from the hip. And I feel like that's a bit dangerous sometimes, to be honest.
Braid brought up a great point about institutional knowledge, Glenn. And I think about the Reporter News and the Bill Whitakers and the Glenn Dromgools and a lot of these reporters that were there pretty much for life. And when you lose institutional knowledge, what do you lose in a newsroom?
Well, you lose the knowledge of the community. I mean, people that have been here forever and that specialized in some area. You know, we had people that specialized in religion coverage. We had people that specialized in business coverage or covering dais or sports or that kind of thing. And they knew what had happened in the past. And we also had a good filing system, and you could go back and read, you know, check the morgue, as we call it, the morgue, and pull out clippings, and that's gone pretty much. But yeah, one of the things that I miss, I think, in newspapers today, and this is not just in Abilene, this is broadly, is personal journalism. There's not the personalities that people like Bill Whitaker, for example, that wrote a front page column, and people would turn to that to see what Bill had to say. They felt like they knew him, and when they feel like you know somebody, I think you have more trust in what you're reading, and you don't know the people now as much. Now, maybe in television still, because you see them every day, but in the newspaper, there's three reporters, and nobody really knows them very well.
That's a really good point.
And, yeah.
Yeah, Glenn, to that effect, I remember Wayne McCormick, who had been there for years and years, would say, when he would check our stories and our scripts and would say, that number doesn't seem right. That doesn't, yeah. I don't remember that being right from last year. And that, and you're right. When you lose those key figures, the legacy figures, you also lose a little bit of that tie to the community. And I feel like that's so important. You were talking about what kind of news we deserve. And I think that our community deserves that. They deserve somebody who cares about what they're reporting and wants them to have that knowledge that maybe many people don't ever have or wouldn't have, you know, without them.
You need some editors, whether it's a broadcast or print. You need somebody who has some institutional knowledge as well as community knowledge and can catch these kind of mistakes that just kind of go through now because there's really no editing going on in the newspaper. We had a whole team of people that were called copy editors. They read a story, not just for grammar, but for accuracy, and would raise questions about things. And you know, you've lost that whole level of
quality control.
Quality control, yeah. Exactly.
Braid Blanks and Glenn Dromgold joining us in the studio for the West Texas Dispatch. If this becomes a news desert, what does that mean for residents and businesses? Who's going to be the watchdogs of local government? This is the West Texas Dispatch. Today we're looking back at 2025. Another story we covered several times in 2025 is the local and regional impact of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. We've spoken to economists and immigration attorneys. In July, one Big Country school district was shocked by the detention of a beloved member of its community. KACU's Heather Claiborne brings us that story.
38-year-old Waldo Rodriguez Garcia left Cuba when he was 19. Soon after he made it to the U.S., he found himself in trouble. He was trying to help 20 other Cubans flee their communist nation by boat with hopes of reaching America. After his arrest, ICE gave him a deportation order. But because the U.S. does not have diplomatic relations with Cuba, officials couldn't send him home. Instead, he was ordered to check in with ICE each year.
I have no clue about immigration status. I'm a citizen, so I had no idea on how he could obtain all of that.
This is Waldo's wife, Sylvia. The couple worked together to figure out his paperwork.
But within time, he obtained his work authorization, and with that comes the Social Security. I think he got that in 2012. I help him renew that every year.
Earlier this month, on July 3rd, they made the annual trek to Dallas for his appointment with ICE. Migrants aren't allowed to take phones or family into the meeting. Sylvia says the usual 30-minute wait dragged on for a couple of hours. Eventually, an ICE agent found her in the waiting area and collected Waldo's phone so he could call Sylvia to explain what was happening.
He said, you know, I've been having this order of deportation for 15 years now. I guess it's time with all this that's going on. And so I was like, no, they can't do this. You know, I broke down crying, and he did too. I just felt like everything stopped, everything just changed in a second.
Waldo's boss, Baird ISD Superintendent Tim Little, was shocked that ICE locked him up. He says district staff has reacted to the news with a range of emotions, from intense sadness to anger bordering on rage.
Waldo was the epitome of what the American dream is supposed to be. Someone who came to this country with nothing and had a family and was building a life and was giving back to his community. And it was just snatched away with no explanation for why.
Later that day, on July 3rd, while ICE took Waldo to a detention center in Alvarado, Sylvia drove home to Gori. It's a tiny town, an hour and a half from Abilene, situated among fields full of cattle and wind turbines. Sylvia spent the 3.5-hour drive figuring out how to break the news to their 6 kids. Waldo had been the sole provider for a decade, working the last 3 years at Baird ISD. This allowed Sylvia to stay home with her young children. She just recently completed her associate's degree and returned to the workforce. Sylvia says she doesn't make enough to provide for the family, and she's not sure how much longer she'll be able to send food packages to Waldo's parents in Cuba. Waldo's detention is also hitting the Baird School District hard.
I'm devastated. I'm upset, you know, about him. He's a friend. He's a worker. We're going to suffer.
James Stevens is principal of Baird High School and Junior High.
We're going to suffer a lot because, A, yes, the kids love him. Stuff gets done. Stuff's not going to get done in the time that it got done before. You're not going to replace him. You need about four people to replace him. We don't have the budget to do that.
The district reached out to Sylvia to offer help. Principal Stevens says she told them that almost everyone checking in at the ICE facility that day was detained.
To me, that's just a bad focus. I'm all for let's get the criminals out of here, but people who are going in to do paperwork to do the right thing, why are you setting up shop there? I'm sorry, that doesn't make sense to me. Criminals are not going to go to the office to do the right thing.
As they organize support for the family, Waldo's friends and coworkers are reaching for any source of help they can think of. Baird Superintendent Tim Little says he was disappointed when his Congressman Roger Williams declined to get involved, citing ethics rules.
I followed that back up with an email pointing out that I was aware of those ethics rules, but there were also a number of things a sitting congressman could do, and I actually enumerated some of those things. I didn't get a response to that one back for 2 or 3 days. And when I did, again, it was just a flat refusal to even look at the case.
Waldo's a good man, and he deserves better than this.
Heather Guthrie teaches English for Baird ISD.
We love him. We've lost a member of our family. And if this can happen to Waldo, it can happen to any of our immigrant community.
More than anything, Superintendent Little wants to know why immigration officials haven't been able to resolve Waldo's status over the past 2 decades.
How many millions of people are sitting out there right now in the same situation because we can't have a sane immigration policy that actually keeps criminals out and keeps people like Waldo, who are hardworking, good people, who give to this community and to this country the security of knowing they're safe here. I don't know why we can't do that.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement did not respond to KACU's request for more information on the case. According to Waldo's wife, Sylvia, he remains at the Prairieland Detention Center south of Fort Worth, and he's declining to sign papers allowing the U.S. to deport him to Mexico. The Department of Homeland Security recently revoked humanitarian parole for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, leaving hundreds of thousands of people like Waldo in limbo. Sylvia says she doesn't really pay attention to the news and hadn't been concerned about Waldo being targeted for removal, but she says Waldo was worried. Sylvia says Waldo set up a safety net in case something happened to him. Waldo had been working with her father raising chickens, goats, and a handful of black Angus cows.
I can tell who the baby cow is.
We'll get them all separated and we'll just try to keep these two in the corral, and then we'll just put the trailer to back it up so they can get in. We can take them to ground. It's about an hour and a half from here.
Sylvia and her father recently sold two of the young cows.
It's an easy process. You just go, drop them off, get the check in the mail within a few days, that week.
Sylvia says her share of the sale will help cover the loss of Waldo's income this month, but there's no extra money for a private attorney, so she scheduled a meeting with Catholic Charities Legal Aid. Sylvia says she's holding out hope that sooner or later, ICE will release Waldo to resume life with her family in North Central Texas. I'm Heather Claiborne in Abilene.
And we have an update on that Waldo Rodriguez story. We were told by the superintendent that he self-deported to Mexico. We asked our student reporters which were their favorite stories. KACU's Bailey Simon had several to pick from. For her, one that rose to the top was a look at maternal health care in rural parts of the state. Almost half of all Texas counties do not have a hospital or birth center offering obstetric care. Shocking. As KACU's Bailey Simon reports, that's a challenge for pregnant women in rural Texas.
Craig Honeycutt is the director of regional services at Hendrick Medical Center in Abilene. He says only 2 of the 18 hospitals in Hendrick's service area have OBGYN doctors and trained labor and delivery nurses.
You know, that, I mean, it's 2025, right? Having a baby is not that big. I mean, it's a big deal in a lot of ways, but it shouldn't be a big deal as far as the medical part of it. But for a lot of these folks, it can be a very big deal.
The problems women going into labor face in rural Texas run the gamut. For example, blood and blood bank platelets are essential for managing postpartum hemorrhages. The hospital in Brownwood, which is about 80 miles southeast of Abilene, has to get platelets delivered from San Angelo, an hour's drive away. And doctors have to decide to do a C-section earlier in rural settings because anesthesiologists and delivery crews aren't necessarily in a hospital 24/7. Yasmin Wilkinson is an OBGYN practicing in Brownwood. She completed her residency in the relatively larger city of Galveston. There, she says hospitals could run a patient from a labor room to the OR and have a baby in less than 10 minutes. Wilkinson said that efficiency is easy to take for granted.
When you move to a small town, when you practice in a rural setting, you really have to kind of modify how you practice. You have to modify, how you look at the care of a patient, particularly someone who's critically ill.
Wilkinson said that her hospital has done a good job of having backup systems in place to deal with emergencies. Hendrick Medical Center in Brownwood has forged partnerships with larger hospitals around the state, so if mothers and newborns need higher-level care, they can be sent to St. David's in Austin or Cook Children's in Fort Worth.
So we have systems in place to do those transfers, to have a whole neonatal team, you know, come out all the way out here, whether by plane or helicopter or ambulance, whatever is appropriate.
In some counties, it takes up to an hour and a half to get to a hospital that delivers babies. When there is no time to drive that far, mothers have their babies at ER hospitals without obstetricians. Honeycutt says the physicians in those hospitals are prepared for labor, but aren't necessarily equipped to manage a situation that doesn't go to plan.
They have some training, and our OB department sends and helps some of the rural facilities around us with that training. Like, we know you don't deliver babies, but you're going to get somebody that's needing to deliver their baby here. And so, you know, they're not like completely oblivious to what's going on. But what they recognize, there's a lot of stuff that that mom and that baby needs that we don't have here.
Some hospitals in rural Texas simply can't afford to deliver babies. In Texas, half of all pregnancies are paid for by Medicaid. Reimbursement rates for Medicaid are very low compared to private insurance. Low reimbursements disincentivize hospitals from having labor units because they're just not profitable.
Right. You can't maximize profits while also doing the right thing for patients 100% of the time. And so in a system where the goal is to make as much money as possible to maximize profits for shareholders, where that is the goal, you are sacrificing taking the best possible care of patients.
Wilkinson said there is not a clear solution to solving the maternity problems in rural America. It would help if there were more OBGYNs. She also said increased reimbursements from insurance companies would go a long way toward simply keeping hospitals open. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. As we continue to look back at the stories our student reporters covered this year, Ashley Henderson's July 4th story on flag etiquette rose to the top. When we think about the visuals that represent America, we might picture the Statue of Liberty, bald eagles, the great seal of the United States, but of course, the most recognizable symbol is the American flag. The flag itself changed throughout the history of the nation, and in recent decades, the etiquette around it has undergone some transformation, too. Here's Ashley Henderson's report.
On July 2, 1776, the Founding Fathers met for the Second Continental Congress and voted to declare independence from Great Britain. Retired State District Judge Lee Hamilton says the Founding Fathers originally thought July 2nd would mark the day of celebration.
On July 3rd, one of the Founding Fathers, John Adams, wrote his wife Abigail that, quote, the second day of July 1776 will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America.
Hamilton says Adams' prediction was only 2 days off because it was not until July 4th, 1776, when they adopted the Declaration of Independence, giving birth to the United States of America. The colors, red, white, and blue, represent bravery, purity, and justice. Its 13 horizontal stripes represent the original colonies, and the 50 stars represent each of the states. Hamilton says while the flag has evolved over time, it continues to symbolize freedom.
The flag is very, very significant. It represents America. It symbolizes America. It invokes emotion and pride, just like the whole idea of celebrating the birthday of America.
Flag etiquette has changed over time. Throughout most of the 20th century, people were careful to display flags properly from flagpoles, as well as lower and store them in respectful ways. And no one would have gone to the beach in American flag swimwear or flip-flops. The U.S. Flag Code lays out specific guidelines for how to honor the flag, describing when the flag should be displayed and how it should be handled. For example, flags should never touch the ground. Nothing should be put on top of it when it's folded. Flags shouldn't be tied back, but allowed to wave freely. It shouldn't be used as a cover, and it's not supposed to be worn as clothing. In recent years, Americans' interaction with the flag has become much more casual, but there are great opportunities to get reacquainted with the history and reverence many hold for Independence Day and the symbols of the nation. For the month of July, the Grace Museum's cultural heritage highlights Independence Day. Lori Thornton, Director of Marketing and Communications, says visitors can explore the history of the national holiday and its local connection, which she thinks makes it more real for people.
They may or may not know that much about history and where it comes from, why we celebrate it, why we have a parade, why we shoot off fireworks and things like that. And so I think for all of the different months, having some connection to our local history just really puts more of a face on it.
Thornton says other than learning about how Abilinians have celebrated over the years, they may be surprised to read about the Safe and Sane movement, which led to changes in safety regulations for fireworks and celebrations.
Actually, at my house, I have an American flag that I fly, so I think it's very important.
Longtime Abilene resident Etta Hall says she thinks everyone should honor the flag because it is a symbol of the country.
I think that we should always celebrate our flag, celebrate America. I just think it's really important, and I think that more people should do it.
Abilene resident and military reservist Nina Diaz says seeing the flag displayed in public makes her feel good about Independence Day. Diaz is the third generation in her family to serve, and her husband is also currently serving in the military. And she says the holiday makes her feel some appreciation for her service. Diaz says with the division and conflict in the country, she thinks it's still important to celebrate Independence Day. Etta Hall agrees. She says she thinks it's more important to celebrate Independence Day now more than ever.
We need to celebrate. We need to have something that we can come together and be proud of. We should absolutely be proud of America and proud of our flag and who we are as people.
Judge Lee Hamilton says while American citizens have the right to choose whether or not to celebrate the holiday, he believes that this is the one holiday all Americans can rally around.
We should reflect on the significant steps that were taken by our founding fathers and still appreciate the action because as a result of their action, we continue to enjoy freedom.
While millions of Americans will be enjoying the traditional July 4th activities, others are exercising their freedom to peaceably assemble this year. More than 150 Free America protests are scheduled this week across all 50 states. In Texas, rallies are planned in Houston and Dallas, protesting federal funding cuts, U.S. involvement in international conflict, and potential cuts to Social Security. The observance of this holiday will look different from picnics to protests. But the stars and stripes represent the freedom that Americans have to choose how they celebrate the 4th of July. I'm Ashley Henderson in Abilene.
And the landscape of college athletics is shifting big time. The name, image, and likeliness, the NIL rights, becoming a central issue for student athletes across all divisions. KACU's Josiah Winnell has this look at the ripple effects that spread to smaller programs and their athletes.
More than $1.5 billion reached the bank accounts of student-athletes last school year, and the Lone Star State tallies up a large portion of the massive new segment of the sports economy. Headlines often focus on the massive deals in Division I football and basketball, like the University of Texas quarterback Arch Manning, who has a projected NIL valuation of nearly $7 million. But the relatively new rules allowing student-athletes to be compensated while they're still in college touch athletes far beyond the national spotlight. John Neese, Hardin-Simmons University Vice President for Athletics, says he thinks the move is fair.
After all of these years where athletes, especially at the Division I level, were receiving minimal compensation for what they were doing. I think it was time for those athletes to receive some sort of compensation. I think, like with so many things, we went from zero to 100 very quickly, and I don't think there's any going back from it.
After the rules were changed in 2021 to allow student athletes to receive compensation for their name, image, and likeness, the new rules were expanded to allow schools to pay them. But very few schools are paying players directly at this point, and the smallest schools don't even give athletic scholarships. NIL opportunities at smaller schools often take the form of sponsorships or product deals rather than large cash payments.
What I've seen for Division III is we've primarily had NIL deals for product. Then it's basically they're receiving some sort of trade out in merchandise or product for what they're doing on social media. And so we do have a handful of athletes who shared with me that they have received something to where they receive a monthly cash payment. It's not a huge amount of money, but for a college student, it's still nice to have.
College is also not cheap. It's not the cheapest.
Brennan Ramirez is a libero, a key defensive position in volleyball for Abilene Christian University.
Second serve from Ramirez is a good one. Line drive just over the net. A big swing.
And I just think being able to like have sponsorships and get money, like I think that is very beneficial to an athlete, especially people who just weren't raised in an atmosphere where money was just easier to access. I think it's super beneficial, and I think it also helps you so much be like, I can love the game and I can focus and perform and not worry about like, how am I going to pay for this? How am I going to pay for that? So I think it's very beneficial.
Ramirez began her career at the University of Texas, one of the top-ranked teams in the country. With that comes a lot of experience and a lot of noise when it comes to NIL. Some of her former UT teammates benefit from NIL deals, like Madison Skinner, who was the first student athlete to sign a deal with HEB. But Ramirez stresses that money hasn't changed the core of the team.
Absolutely not. At Texas, they're great girls, and they all love God as well. And I think they just let God like keep them rooted. And like Maddie Skinner, for example, amazing person. Yeah. She's super sweet, not only good at volleyball, but she's also amazing while also having a bunch of NIL deals. I just think she works hard for everything that she has, and she's also a really good person. So I don't think it really like changes.
Ramirez says NIL is a tool that enhances an athlete's experience rather than defines it. For those like her who are part of the 99% not receiving massive deals, the benefits are still meaningful.
Well, I feel like I could definitely categorize myself as the 99%. Mm-hmm. So I think just like really focusing on my job right now and then being able to slowly move into it. I definitely don't think an athlete needs to have a ton of NIL deals to be great. And I just think stats mean more than what you see on social media. And I think NIL just builds onto confidence.
And while he's a fan of the deals, Hardin Simmons' John Neese admits compliance can be tricky for small programs.
At a Division III school where so many of us wear different hats, my initial reaction was of concern because I'm the one whose name is on compliance. From my perspective in the chair I sit in, I was concerned about, A, how do we make sure people understand there still is compliance with this? How do we track that compliance? And then C, how do we educate people about what are the things that truly make up NIL?
Hardin Simmons relies on a company to help educate the students on compliance and connect them to opportunities.
Yeah, so we're in our third year of working with a company called Open Doors, which is out of Omaha, and they come on our campus twice a year and meet with all of our athletic teams and share with them what Open Doors can do for them, but then they also share a lot of the education.
Despite the challenges, Neese says NIL is increasingly important.
Even if students don't ever utilize the opportunities for NIL, I think they want to feel like they at least have the option to do it.
It may take years to see where all the ripples reach, and in the early years of this new arena, coaches will likely find themselves not only guiding their players through growth on the field, but needing to help them navigate the rules and perks of being paid as college athletes. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
It's time for West Texas Roots. One of our favorite segments for West Texas Roots is a surprising love story and was picked up by your friends at the Texas Standard for everyone to hear. Take another listen to this remixed version of Randy Billings' story.
I was coming back from junior high, crossing the street, and I saw a guy had a pecan tree in his front yard. He had just planted it. And I thought that was the most wonderful thing. When I graduated from college, I went to Hardin-Simmons University, and then there we used to have a place called Wolf Nursery down at the intersection of all right off South First Street there. And they had a Red Meyers pecan cracker, and it cracked 80 nuts per minute. And I thought that was just the most fantastic thing in the world. I just knew I had to have one. I went to work for the state of Texas and worked there for many years, and I finally retired. But in the meantime, I decided that I would save up my money and I would buy me a pecan cracking business. At Abilene Pecan, we do a wonderful job of buying and selling, cracking and shelling. And I just really enjoy when the people come by and I get a chance to visit with them. As you can see, we have pecan pralines, and we have pecan brittle and pecan glazed nuts, and just enjoy working with pecans, which is kind of a strange anomaly to come from an auditor for the state of Texas into the pecan business. But nevertheless, that's where I am. It's not a money-making business, I assure you. So it's just something fun to do, and it gives you a chance. It keeps you alive, and it keeps you younger. It does that. Because I find that when I sit down, I tend to want to stay that way and don't want to do that. You want to keep up and moving, and that's a real good thing. I think there must be something in my genes because my father, he worked in the oil field out in West Texas for many, many years. But when he finally retired, we bought him a pecan cracker and pecan shelling equipment, and he felt the very same way about it. In fact, he'd say, "Well, Randy, you know, it's the strangest thing. I can be hurting from top to bottom, and somebody drives up and they want to buy pecans, and it's just like a shot of adrenaline. I just jump up and I want to run out there." I kind of thought, well, I knew what he was talking about until it was my turn, and I just enjoy the customer relations and seeing the people, and he did too. He really did. So you must have a pecan abnormality in your gene pool that makes you want to like pecans. You know, it's a strange thing, but nevertheless, that's just the way life is.
Randy Billings shared his story at the Texas Farm Ranch and Wildlife Expo. We are so thankful for all the folks of West Texas who share their stories with us all year. And we're looking for more tales of love, overcoming hardship, family traditions, and communities in West Texas. If you heard stories from your Aunt Bertha or Uncle Morris, if you've got a grandmother who loves to tell of learning in a one-room school or shopping at the general store, we want to know. Send your email to info@kacu.org with the subject line, West Texas Roots. This is the best of the West Texas Dispatch. Each summer, cyclists from across the region roll into Buffalo Gap for the Tour de Gap, a two-day bike race that winds through some of the most scenic terrain in the big country. KACU's Alexis Jones spoke with one of the race organizers about the history and community spirit behind the event, and with the head of this year's charity partner, the Presbyterian Medical Care Mission, to learn how the race is helping expand access to health care for local families.
In the early light of a July morning, the streets of Buffalo Gap are buzzing with energy. Cyclists check their tires, helmets are strapped, shoes clicked into pedals. It's race day in the big country. For 42 years, the Tour de Gap has brought riders from all over Texas to the rolling roads just south of Abilene. What started as a casual weekend ride has grown into a full-scale charity cycling event with a loyal following.
Just a bunch of people just getting together on a weekend saying, "Hey, you know, let's just go do a ride together." And back in the 80s, that happened, and it has slowly evolved.
Jim McDonald, the owner of the cycling store Bike Town, has helped shape the event for the past two decades.
In the early 2000s, my wife and I got involved with it and kind of started to make it more organized. We started working with the food bank here in town, and that's really when it really started to take off, and being partnered with a charity that benefited somebody like that.
This year's charity partner is the Presbyterian Medical Care Mission, a local nonprofit providing health care to those without insurance.
So we are a doctor's office for individuals who do not have medical insurance and are adults and on the lower income side.
Brady Hardwell is the executive director of the mission. He says the clinic charges around $25 a visit, and with the help of donations, they're able to keep costs for labs and prescriptions extremely low.
We can get medications months at a time for $3 for patients. And so for our ability to keep those costs low, where we rely heavily on community support, namely through community grants, local foundation grants, governmental grants, as well as fundraising. And so this is a newfound fundraising opportunity for us. And so for the first year ever, first time ever, we're partnering up with Biketown to co-host this great 42-year event.
The support doesn't just come from sponsors. It comes from riders, too. Hartwell has ridden and toured the gap 3 times.
My family and I, we're a little bit scattered. And so we always use the Tour de Gap as a good opportunity to get the family together. And so, you know, we would meet late July. My grandparents still live north of town and near Impact. And so we would all convene there. And then when we needed a break from each other, we could hop on a bike and ride the Tour de Gap.
The race welcomes a range of bikers, whether they're seasoned cyclists or weekend cruisers.
There are 3 great route options available for all levels of participants. So we've got an 11-mile route, and we really kind of coined that as being our family-friendly one. You know, some pull a little cart and the kiddos behind. Just have a lot of fun with it.
The medium ride is 50 kilometers, or about 31 miles, and the longest stretch is 100 kilometers, or 62 miles, winding through some of the region's most scenic and surprisingly bikeable terrain.
Buffalo Gap is a small community south of Abilene. The trees are bigger. There are really nice live oaks all over that downtown Buffalo Gap area, and that's where we get started. This year's routes are going to go over Belle Plains and right past Steamboat Mountain, through Tuscola, out past the state park.
While racers can choose an easy route, getting to the starting line is a lot of work. It takes dozens of volunteers from all sorts of organizations, from Boy Scouts to Hendrick Health Clubs.
We've got a list of probably 80 volunteers every year that come out and help. There's all kinds of people that show up. They want to help and give back, but don't necessarily want to ride or can't ride. And I've got several riders who maybe got hurt this year, you know, broken knee or whatever, and can't ride. And so that's one way that they can continue to give back.
McDonald says visitors from Dallas, Austin, or Houston say open West Texas skies and quiet roads are part of the appeal.
I consistently hear it from people. You guys have great riding out here. And I think if you're from town, you feel like maybe you grew up saying that it's not bike friendly. And actually, it probably is more friendly than you might think.
And the planning never stops.
Next year's event planning will start next week. And we'll have kind of a shakedown meeting to talk about what went right and what went wrong this year and how we can improve.
Registration for next year's race opens in May, but McDonald is happy to chat about Tour de Gap, give cycling tips, or help with the repairs any time of the year at Biketown. And if you're new to cycling, McDonald says, just come on in.
And you can get started here. We help organize basic group rides. We're very involved with the bike clubs that are here in town, whether that be an off-road package or more of a gravel bike or road bikes, all of that stuff we carry. So we'd love to have you. We can be a great resource for people that want to get started.
For Harwell, the Presbyterian Medical Mission partnering with Tour de Gap is more than a fundraiser. It was a perfect match.
We love the history behind it. We love how it's a very community-oriented event. And then at the same time, also the slogan, you know, miles that matter, ride to help bridge gaps in healthcare, just sounded so good.
From the family-friendly ride to the 100K challenge, every pedal stroke at Tour de Gap helps close the distance between communities, between causes, and for some, between themselves and better health. For West Texas Dispatch, I'm Alexis Jones in Buffalo Gap.
life's no fun. All I really gotta do is live and die, but I'm in a hurry and don't know why.
You may know that Alexis Jones is now working for KERA in Dallas. We were so thankful for her and all she brought to this program with her work on West Texas roots and her arts and culture beat. And we'll be excited to hear her reporting from the entire east side of the Lone Star State. This has been a special edition of the West Texas Dispatch. There were far too many great stories and interviews to fit them all into this episode. Check out the archives of our shows on our podcast page at kacu.org. And be sure to subscribe to the podcast, which is also available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in this year. We're here each Wednesday at noon, and we've got great things for you in 2026. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Happy New Year from all of us at the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque.